The first flashes of fireflies are good indicators that summer has arrived, and we'll probably be seeing them just a few weeks from now. Fireflies create their light through bioluminescence, which is also found in some worms, fungus, and in many creatures in the oceans. On this week's Please Explain, we will find out how bioluminescence works and how scientists study it. Joining us are John Sparks, Associate Curator and Curator in Charge, Department of Ichthyology at the American Museum of Natural History, and David Gruber, Assistant Professor at the City University of New York and a Research Associate at the museum. They have organized an exhibit called Creatures of Light, Nature's Bioluminescence, which is on view at the American Museum of Natural History through January 6th of next year. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And we also invite our listeners to join this conversation. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org. So, John, let's begin with you. Roughly how many species of organisms have bioluminescent qualities? Do we know?
No, we don't. There's no definitive number of you ask me, total number of species. For example, I work on fish, and there's probably about 2,000 species, all marine fish. There's no freshwater fish that are bioluminescent. But for some groups like dinoflagellates, which are, there's thousands of species, about 30% of those are bioluminescent. So we really don't have a total number, but for a lot of groups, we no, it's very prevalent.
And I assume, David, that we are still discovering new ones all the time.
Yeah, on almost every dive that researchers go down below about 1,000 feet, they'll find new glowing organisms.
Since it's found in different kinds of organisms, did it evolve independently in each one?
Yeah, if you look at the distribution of bioluminescence across the tree of life, you'll see it's in numerous different groups, all the way up from single-celled organisms like bacteria, dinoflagellates, up through worms, starfishes, all the way up through the vertebrates and fishes. And in these different groups, there's different chemistries involved. It's the same end product of cold light, but different chemical processes.
But I would assume that all of these different processes evolved because they were based on survival strategies.
You would think that, but if you trace it back, we even have bacteria that are glowing. So these go back even before, there was eyesight and vision.
So the last thing bacteria, I would think, would want us to be able to do is to see them.
No. So it probably came about as a way to get rid of some of these oxygen products that were coming out in the universe several billion years ago.
So it's just a matter of working within the growing amount of oxygen that was developing on this planet?
Yeah, the thing is, the luciferins, and these are the molecules, the actual light producers, you have a reaction of two chemicals basically coming together, although the chemicals do vary, as I mentioned, which gives us a hint that it's evolved numerous times across the tree of life. You have a luciferin, which is a light emitter, and a luciferase, which basically an enzyme that helps the reaction take place in the presence of oxygen, and it gives off light as opposed to heat.
Does bioluminescence take a lot of energy to produce?
In terms of energy, yeah, for some of the organisms, it's a costly process to produce. So, and you've got organisms that are self-luminescent that are producing these chemicals. Either they're getting it through their diet or they're synthesizing them on their own. So it's very costly essence.
But you say it also creates heat.
Very little.
And heat always requires a certain amount of energy loss.
It's a very low amount of heat compared to light produced. So it's called a cold reaction.
As I mentioned earlier, one of the bioluminescent creatures that most people are familiar with is the firefly. But isn't it actually a beetle and not a fly?
Fireflies are beetles. They're not flies. There's lots of different names they go by depending on the stage of their life. Sometimes the larval forms are called glowworms even.
So they glow even when they're in the larval state?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see if you trace, in terms of this exhibit, we brought in an expert on fireflies and kind of recreate the evolution of their system of flashing and communication. And it started out as a very simple kind of system where the larvae only glow, and then you get continuous glow in adults, and then you get this elaborate flashing we see now.
Equally in males and females?
No, not equally in males and females. It depends on the group, and it depends on the species or genus. Some of them you get females that signal back to males. Others you get that use deception and will actually mimic a male's signal of another species.
And do we know why they flash? Is this, again, just a matter of processing oxygen? Because they seem to flash in patterns.
They flash in, yeah. It's very what's really interesting about fireflies in the eastern U.S., if you go west of the Continental Divide, they use pheromones. They're not using flashing patterns. East, they flash, and they do it in numerous different ways. You've seen different, not only different flashing patterns, different flight patterns, and different colors as well.
So we have this odd thing where we have a similar species, but in the eastern U.S., they flash, and in the western U.S., they just emit some kind of odor to attract the
opposite sex? They're similar, but it's one of these phenomena that people don't really understand well. But in the eastern U.S., we do have the flashing fireflies, which is great for us because we get to observe them.
But are the ones that flash the brightest the ones that are going to be most attractive to a potential mate?
Well, the guy, expert Mark Branham, who we worked with on this, it wasn't necessarily brightness, I think. It's more in terms of the speed of the flash, or they're looking at things like that, the pattern of the flash versus intensity.
So, those patterns, is that a kind of a language?
Yeah, it's like their own Morse code. So they're very specific. And we have in the Creatures of Light exhibition at the open at the museum right now, we have an interactive where you can actually interact with fireflies. You mimic the signal that a male would give off, and you can see if females will signal back to you, depending on how well you do it.
Now, David, you photograph bioluminescence, don't you?
Yes,
so how
do
you catch a firefly? Those flashes come so quickly. I know whenever I want to take a picture of something interesting, my finger always hits the button 10 seconds or at least a half a second too late.
Yeah, but it's photographing bioluminescence is incredibly difficult. Not only is it, you have to be quick on the trigger, but you forget how the dark adapted eye, when you're outside at night, it becomes it becomes very sensitive. And cameras are unfortunately not as sensitive, at least the ones that you get off the shelf. So if you try to photograph this, your cameras don't get, you have to put it on a very long exposure in order to see this, and this usually get those kind of blurry photographs. Mm-hmm. But now with recent scientific imaging, you're starting to get better and better and better. But most of these are designed for black and white.
But it's unlikely I'm going to get very much of a picture when I take my smartphone out, and try to snap pictures of fireflies.
No,
if there are a lot of them.
And that's why if you go on to there's very few. When we were putting together this exhibit, we found there's just not that much videos of bioluminescent organisms.
Really?
There's the footage with, especially I work mainly in the ocean too, but there is some, but the footage is pretty sparse.
Now, I'd imagine it's a lot easier to photograph a bioluminescent mushroom. They exist?
They exist, and they're all around us here, actually. We've got three common species in eastern woodlands right around this area. And one of them that we feature in the exhibition, I actually had growing in my backyard, and I took a photo that's been used, kind of going around with our media kit. But you have to take it with timed exposure. So I used about a 30-minute timed exposure, and you can get really remarkable images. But it's, again, one of these things that if you let your eyes adapt, most people would never notice they're walking right over these mushrooms, but they're actually quite bright.
Should I assume that it's not a good idea to eat a glowing mushroom?
Yeah, most of them they probably won't kill you, but they'll make you fairly sick.
Now, what's the advantage of glowing for a fungus?
Well, that's one of the questions that remains unanswered. Nobody knows. There are a couple of theories out there. One is that by glowing, they may be attracting predators that will disperse their spores. The other flip side of that coin is that they may, by glowing again, detract predators from eating them and protect themselves. But nobody knows for mushrooms.
Do they glow all the time, or we only see them at night, are they likely to just light up in the dark?
No, the funguses that grow the mushrooms, they are glowing all the time, depending on the particular mushroom. Some you only get the mycelium. You don't get the actual fruiting bodies, the things we would call mushrooms that glow. And others, the whole thing glows, even the mycelium, the fruiting body itself. And when those are fruiting, they're glowing all the time.
And then there are these bioluminescent worms, really bright ones in New Zealand. Do they live in the soil?
You're talking about the glowworms from caves in New Zealand? Yeah, they're actually another one it's the common name glowworm, but they're actually fly larvae. So they're gnats. They're a fungus gnat that it's the larval form that glows from its posterior end, and it hangs these sticky fishing lures down. And then anything that's in that cave, mainly aquatic insects, the adult adults of aquatic insects that are flying around or getting blown in, they get entangled in those snares.
But they're only in New Zealand?
They're in Australia as well, these glowworms. And we've actually got in Appalachia a very similar form that does the same thing but lives kind of on the banks of streams.
Now, David, you specialize in bioluminescent sea creatures. Why do we know why things glow in the water? I can imagine if you're at the lower depths, you might just want to glow a bit to be able to see where you're going.
Right, right. I mean, you have to think about how, you know, 71% of our planet is ocean. And of this, the light it goes down to about 1% when you're down at about 100 meters or about 330 feet. So with the average depth of the oceans being, you know, in the Atlantic, it's about 3,700 meters. You have this huge expanse of the world that is enveloped in complete darkness. So these animals are there, and they're using this as everything. They're using this as a way to find mates. They use it as a way to
Hey, I'm here.
They flash. They could communicate to each other. Imagine if we just had the lights out. We were living in a world of complete darkness all the time, and we only had our own light to be able to defend ourselves or attract or find each other. That's the kind of world that much of our planet is enveloped in.
But do they just glow naturally, or do they depend on receiving sunlight to kind of charge their batteries?
They're not things that use sunlight to charge their batteries are photosynthetic, which is much of all the plant life, and that's where much of the energy on the Earth comes from. But as it drifts down, as these things the particles of food drift down, they don't need the sunlight to charge this. This is like they produce this fuel and spark plug on their own and use this to give off light.
My guests are David Gruber, assistant professor at the City University of New York, a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History, and John Sparks, associate curator and curator in charge in the Department of Ichthyology at the American Museum of Natural History. And they are organizers of an exhibit at the museum that's running for a while, all the way through to January 6th of next year, called Creatures of Light, Nature's Bioluminescence. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. John, you were talking about dinoflagellates earlier.
Yes.
These are both plant and animal
organisms? Well, that's one of the
organisms.
Things that always comes up. Say, are they plants? Are they animals?
Yeah, would have really been a problem with 20 questions when the question was always, is it animal or is it vegetable?
Yeah, some of them are photosynthetic, so they have chloroplasts or chloroplast-like structures in them, so they were classified as algae or plants for a long time. But when you look at the tree of life, we're mainly interested in general relationships rather than these broad categories. So they fall out more closely related to animals now, as do mushrooms and funguses and things like that.
Are all of them bioluminescent?
No. Only it's estimated that about 30% of dinoflagellates are bioluminescent. But then you have these amazing species that produce these bioluminescent bays, or these you see waves that are glowing, people surfing glowing waves, that's due to bioluminescence from dinoflagellates.
Are they related to red tides?
Yeah, they produce red tides as well. So that's the flip side. You know, dinoflagellates can be extremely beautiful and produce these bioluminescent displays, but they're also, a lot of species, very toxic.
And it was discovered that they have a circadian clock?
Yeah, so they, well, you might want...
How big are these things?
The bigger ones are, you could fit about 10 of them end to end on a millimeter.
Oh, so they're
really small.
We really have to look at them through microscopes.
You could just about see them. You know, they look like a little speck if you're looking at them. So you do need a microscope to see them. And but even though they're so small, they're incredibly, they're almost like aliens. They're one of the lesser studied of the phytoplankton, because their DNA and their genomes are just huge. You know, 25 times the DNA of a person on average is the dinoflagellates. So they do all kinds of really weird things. You know, like John said, some of them could both photosynthesize and get their light from the sun, or they could slurp out another cell. They can eat other things. And this is from an animal that is one cell big.
So the photosynthesis is the reason that they shine brightest on nights that follow very sunny days?
It is. You could say that. In a way, they learn a lot about circadian rhythms from them because they don't, during the day, they're capturing light. And then at night, they use some of the same machinery to produce their bioluminescence. So they were able to kind of, if you were to take them in the middle of the day and then take them out and put them in a dark room and try to shake them and give off light, they won't.
But you shake them, you can jostle them, and that's usually when they light up?
Yeah, and that's what we've used, you know, to our advantage kind of in the exhibition, is we've got bubbles going up through a colony of dinoflagellates of various species that are bioluminescent. When they're disturbed, they'll flash. They'll give off a flash so people can actually see that.
And are they also flashing during the day without us noticing? Or are they usually just light up at night?
Yeah, they just light up at night. So when they're capturing energy from the sun, they're unable to photosynthesize to produce light.
What makes what are the conditions at Mosquito Bay in Vieques, Puerto Rico that make it an ideal habitat for bioluminescent dinoflagellates?
Well, I just traveled down there. So, I mean, part of the exhibit we were testing out some new very low light color cameras, and it's still debated what it is about the bay. Like I said, these guys are just really complicated in their nutritional needs. And this bay has a lot of mangroves, and that some people say it releases the decaying mangrove leaves, give off a lot of vitamin B12, which is one of the requirements. It's also, it has a nice little opening. It's only about a meter deep, 3 meters deep. And it has a nice little opening that kind of flushes it out. So it just has this perfect storm of dinoflagellate-loving conditions.
Well, you would think that when people who take a lot of vitamin B12 loll around at the beach for a long time, that they would start glowing, but it doesn't work out that way. Do we have any of this DNA in our systems?
I mean, I haven't tried that going to the beach, but it's worth the.
Have you photographed the dinoflagellates?
Yeah, we do. We grew them in the lab before kind of handing them off to the exhibit people at the museum, and we were test. I took one of the laboratory rooms, and we kind of took off we taped up all the windows so it was totally dark in there, and we brought in as testing all these new cameras that are that are just incredibly sensitive. You know, they're like $30,000-$40,000 cameras that can get one photon of light. And we were toying around with them to try to get some imagery.
Yeah, so the goal with kind of using these cameras, the tradition, a lot of the imagery you see out there for bioluminescence is fairly blurry. It's kind of hazy. What we want to do with these really sensitive cameras is get basically a pinprick of light, very detailed. And with the dinoflagellates, we're trying to do throughout their bodies, they have these little light-emitting scintillons, the regions that give off the luminescence. And instead of the whole cell kind of glowing, we want to try and see, you know, morphologically how they're doing it.
Do they only live in salt water?
These, the bioluminescent ones, yes.
Are there any bioluminescent sea creatures that live in freshwater?
Yeah, there's freshwater. It's extremely rare for a number of reasons, which we can talk about. But mainly, you see some larval forms of insects that are freshwater for part of their life. But as far as anyone knows, there's only one organism. It's a limpet from New Zealand called Ladia neritoides, and it lives its entire life in fresh water. And it's the only bioluminescent creature so far found that lives its entire life that way.
Well, that would suggest that salt water is one of the factors that allows so many of these sea creatures to glow.
It could be. The thinking is kind of with bioluminescence that when you think of the oceans, they're enormous. It's an enormous habitat, as Dave was talking about. It's by far the largest habitable space on Earth for life. And it's the oceans have been around a long time. So you've got an old kind of the stable environment with a huge region of it that's dark. It's a huge environment for bioluminescence to evolve. Now, when you contrast that with lake environments, most of these are much younger, much more ephemeral. There aren't that many regions of the lakes of the world you can think of that are perpetually dark, and a lot of these regions that are dark are anoxic, so they're not real good environments for bioluminescence to evolve. So that's kind of the thinking, that the ocean's just this enormous habitat.
But the only way we can see them is by going down in submersibles?
Not always. I mean, I work on the group I started working on initially are a bioluminescent group of fish found in the Indo-Pacific, basically from east coast of Africa out to Australia or Fiji, called pony fishes, and they're shallow water. And it's kind of, they have a system analogous to what you'd find in fireflies. The males have very elaborate flashing patterns, morphology that's correlated with that, and they signal to females. Otherwise, the fish look pretty much identical externally, silvery, kind of really nondescript, boring. You call it considered boring fishes, but internally it's remarkable.
And then there are other fish like the anglerfish and the tube shoulder that also glow. But do they all pretty much have the same chemistry?
There's some anglerfish that are able to, they make their own bioluminescent. And they also, everyone's probably really familiar with Nemo, which is an anglerfish. They have a lure that that is bacteria, usually a single species of bacteria that the fish will cultivate. And when they hit a certain number, they start glowing. And they will flush these out every day. And they'll use this, so they'll kind of enslave this bacteria here. And that will glow, and they will use that as a lure to attract to attract other animals.
They keep the bacteria on their bodies?
In a special organ, mm-hmm. that they feed them.
Yeah, and what's kind of remarkable about these anglerfish, it's only the female that glows, that has the lure. And in one genus we feature in the exhibitions, Linophryne, and they're the only organism known that uses two systems. They make their own light by mixing the chemicals themselves in a very elaborate chin barbel that almost looks like a growth, a tree coming off their chin. And in the lure that's over their head, they sequester bacteria and use it. And these are only the females. The males are really diminutive. The male basically becomes a parasite on the female if they find one. They latch on and they actually degenerate. Their brain degenerates, their eyes degenerate, and they
become humans.
Yeah, exactly. So they latch on, they fuse to the female, and she has a ready partner for life.
When they first found them, they thought it was just some parasite. They were kind of, oh, there's some parasite on these, and then they soon realized that was the males.
Yeah. We will be taking some calls after we return from a brief break. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are John Sparks, Associate Curator and Curator in Charge of the Department of Ichthyology at the American Museum of Natural History, and David Gruber, Assistant Professor at the City University of New York and a Research Associate at the American Museum of Natural History. Again, 212-433-9692. Just one other thing before we go into the break. We have a slideshow from the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. If you want to know what we're talking about, well, you'll get to see a few of these creatures if you go to WNYC.org and then the Leonard Lopate Show. We are back with John Sparks and David Gruber, the organizers of an exhibit currently on view at the American Museum of Natural History. It'll be there through January 6th of next year. It's called Creatures of Light, Nature's Bioluminescence. And you really go through all the things we're discussing here, including giving us all sorts of anatomical information about these various creatures. So some of them are incredibly small. What happens? You stick them under a microscope and do the same kind of dissection I had to do in my biology class?
Yeah, it'd be analogous to that, depending on the organism you're looking at. You use different techniques for something as large as the fish I'm looking at. If I'm just looking at their anatomy of the light organ inside these fish, I can cut them open under a regular dissecting scope. When you're looking at creatures like dinoflagellates, which David works more on, then you might use more high power microscopes. It's the same standard techniques.
Let's take some calls, okay? Alice from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I live in the West 70s, between Central Park and Riverside Park. And years ago, I had, along with the flies and the pesky mosquitoes, we had fireflies. And I know I don't have the mosquitoes and the flies. I don't miss them. But I miss the fireflies. It made me feel that I'm in contact with nature a little.
So you're saying that when they sprayed to get rid of the other insects, the fireflies disappeared as well?
Yeah, and I have nothing now. There's no.
Can you bring them back without bringing back the mosquitoes?
Yeah, that's an unfortunate consequence, you know, of using pesticides. Is you get the you get rid of things that are nuisances, but you also get rid of things that are you know, attractive, and people find that kind of ties them to nature. And that's happened in a lot of different places. Fireflies, you know, talking to experts on it, say they're declining throughout their range in the eastern U.S. Lots of different species. You just don't see the numbers they used to.
Well, we're seeing the disappearance of bees and all sorts of other creatures as well, all because of the fact that we use so many pesticides?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert, you know, on insects or pesticides, but I think that's a big part of it. And also, I think, you know, one of the factors with a lot of these things, with fireflies in particular, is habitat destruction as well. You're losing a lot of their, you know, they like meadows and environments like that, and there's just not that many left.
Well, what do they live on when we, you know, if we lose bees, we will lose something really important for the environment. Same with bats. Are fireflies a positive force in the environment? Do you know?
I mean, it would be sad if they're gone.
Aesthetically, for sure.
Well, I mean, they're predators out there eating other insects, so I imagine the balance, you know, anything, we just don't know at this point. I mean, if you lose them, something will be thrown off. My guess is probably yes. There'll be consequences that will be dire.
Brenda from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I wondered if there is any speculation or evidence that any of these exotic substances and organs and mechanisms for creating light have any kind of application for people, for medical research, or any type of application for humans.
Yeah, it's. I think you're hitting upon a point. Compounds that give off light and reprocess light have probably been the most useful tool in biomedicine in the last decade. There's all sorts of uses. They're doing cancer research with them. They're understanding you know, some things that it processes that are happening inside cells. So the uses are just increasing every year.
Okay.
Is there one particular one you could name?
Well, I mean, there's firefly luciferase, which is used in a lot of enzymes. And there's also from a jellyfish, there's a photoprotein that senses calcium. So we've been learning a lot about how calcium interacts in cells by using this jellyfish bioluminescent protein.
Thank you so much for your call. We were talking about the various things going extinct endangered our coral reefs. And in the exhibit, there are photographs of a coral reef. Can you explain how you took that photograph, David?
We, as part of the exhibit, we touch upon two themes. We touch upon animals that give off light, and some animals that give off light have this other ability to kind of absorb the light that's being given off and reprocess that into another color. And some organisms just have that ability on its own. Corals have this other biofluorescent ability on their own. And what we did is it was sort of an art and science fusion where we teamed up with this underwater photographer who specializes in taking these Ansel Adams landscape photographs of coral reefs and stitching them together.
But you say that they are biofluorescent rather than bioluminescent. What's the difference?
The biofluorescent means is if you shoot blue light on them, they will then absorb this blue light and then re-emit it back out as say, green or reds. So that is what biofluorescent, they don't actually make their own light. They absorb and then reprocess and send it back out.
Didn't you discover a fluorescent stingray while you were preparing for this exhibit?
Yeah, that was eels and stingrays. It was very unexpected. I went down with David and his group to help photograph this Bloody Bay wall off of Little Cayman Island. And it was at night. We were shooting images of the wall as a kind of a comparison to a daylight photograph to show green and red fluorescence. And an eel happened to kind of serendipitously swim in front of one of our photographer's cameras, and it had never been found before, a bright green glowing eel.
Our number here, by the way, is 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Is fluorescence visible in daylight as well as in the dark?
In daylight, it would mostly be swamped out by the bright light that you get just from the sun. But at lower levels of light, say when you're getting under moonlight or down deeper, where it's a spectrally shifted kind of blue environment in the ocean, then it's potentially you could see it if you have the visual capability to see it.
Can you describe what GFP is and how it was discovered?
GFP is one of the proteins or family of proteins that are responsible for absorbing. This one absorbs blue light and then sends it back out as green light. And this was found in a bioluminescent jellyfish off the coast of Washington. And in the process of finding the bioluminescent compound that was actually in purity was giving off a blue light, they noticed that that if you looked at it in the water, it was actually green. So there was this other compound that was absorbing it and then sending it back out as green light.
So when you're doing research, you can attach it to a cell and. Makes it easier to observe it under a microscope?
Yeah, this one is the protein itself looks like it's very small, and it looks like a Coca-Cola can, and it has these three amino acids in the center. So they absorb it and they kind of vibrate and then they send it back out. But this ability of shining one color of light and then looking at the light that's coming back off has just been incredibly useful for scientists. They could then take this gene and put it in front of any gene that they're interested in and then watch that interact in a cell. So you can now see a certain protein moving around, who it's talking to, who it's communicating with. And it's really just kind of opened our eyes to so many of life processes that we couldn't see before this.
Now, we're using the word fluorescent. Fluorescent is also used to describe a certain kind of a bulb. Is there a connection, or is it just the word the same? Is there a similar process there?
It is no. There. When we speak of biofluorescent, we're doing something different.
But you do get the same. I mean, with a fluorescent bulb, you would get an energizing source that then fires up some other gas. Because what you get with fluorescence is the difference is you need an external input of light. So anything that's biofluorescent is going to require some external input, whether it's from sunlight or the flashes of our camera. And in the process, you always lose energy, so it's going to give off a wavelength of less energy. So if you shine blue light at it, you're going to get either green or red or yellow off of it. So that's kind of the procedure, as opposed to bioluminescence, where your chemical reaction is taking place inside the organism. It doesn't require an external energy source of light.
Rick from Englewood, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Is this the same Dave Gruber that went with Vincent Pinnebone to Lizard Island in Australia? And if so, I'm wondering where you guys are at with fluorescent coral research since I participated in your expedition back in 2001.
Wow, Rick, it's great to hear from you. That's it's a blast from the past. We're planning a trip right now. John included. We're going off to the Solomon Islands in a few weeks, and where we're going now is we're besides looking for fluorescence in coral, we're looking for infrared fluorescent proteins, which would be really useful for bioimaging because it penetrates deeper into cells. And also with John, we're looking for fluorescence within fishes and rays.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, great to hear from you, Rick.
Have you stopped doing that kind of work?
I still am. In fact, I spent 3 years working on the Census of Marine Life, documenting all kinds of marine science, and that's what I do for a living now. I document marine science for television and documentaries.
Well, thank you so much for calling us.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
Now, John, hatchetfish use bioluminescence to camouflage themselves, don't they? How does that work?
Yeah, and that's a fairly common theme with a lot of creatures in the ocean, not just fishes. Squids use it as well. So what they'll do is they have these small organs, which we call photophores, along their ventrum, that mean on their underside. And what they can do is match downwelling light. So sunlight or moonlight, some of these fish migrate vertically quite a bit over a 24-hour period. And they'll match the downwelling light, so they're kind of basically disappear to a predator lurking below. When a predator looks up, the light level is the same as the downwelling light. The hatchet fish disappears. And it's a great anti-predation strategy.
And can that be applied anywhere else? Or is that unless you're a hatchet fish?
You can talk about the cookie cutter shark.
Yeah, there's a shark that does a really takes it that one step further. The ventrum of the shark again is covered with these light organs, these little spots of light, but it has one section of it that isn't, and it remains black. So it makes itself look much, much smaller than the fish actually is. When something comes up to try and take a bite of the cookie cutter shark, it gets a surprise and gets bitten, a bite taken out of it itself. And they're aptly named. They take very cookie size cuts out of the things they attack. So they use it for deception as well.
Let's go to another call from Ramaswamy of Closter, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, I live in northern New Jersey, and you mentioned the bioluminescent mushrooms, fungi, that kind of thing. Can you tell me specifically where I might be able to find these and at what time of year?
The easiest time to find them is going to be in warm weather over the summer when you might see the fruiting bodies out. But what you really have to do, I mean, there are a number of species. For instance, one that's fairly common is Pinellus stipticus, and it's fairly small. It looks like a kind of like little interleaved maybe shells on a branch. But if you go out at night, you would need to be out on basically a night where there's no moon. It's completely dark, and just let your eyes adjust in the woods, and I'm sure you'll come across them. It's quite common in the region.
Thank you for calling us.
Thank you.
A listener asks, are different colors of light dependent on different proteins, or is there a different chemical process to create a green glow versus a blue glow?
These proteins are kind of a super family, and there's lots of different colors of them. And scientists have also engineered them to give off even more colors. But the primary colors that we find in the environment are green and red, green being the most. And if you think about this in the...
These are complementary colors. Is that any significance in that, or is that just a coincidence?
It's probably not. It's probably more than some of these use it for contrast, such as, we see these beautiful, like, flower patterns of the... That are invisible to the eye. It's this hidden world. So what John and I have been doing is we've been swimming around a lot at night with blue lights and yellow filters over our eyes, and we're finding that that there's lots of different fluorescence down in the ocean. But back to the question of colors is, again, it's mainly what we find is green is one of the most abundant, and then we have lots of reds as well.
But different chemicals creating them?
No, the proteins are quite similar. So there might be a tiny little conformation in the molecule that'll change it from green to red.
But what's interesting, too, and that's for biofluorescence, for bioluminescence, what you get...
possibly a general global effect.
What you get sometimes for bioluminescence is these organisms will alter the emitted wavelength of light by putting filters over it or using some other compounds in their light organs to alter the emitted light as well. So they're able to alter the light they can emit. And getting back to, you mentioned the complementary colors, which is kind of interesting about that. If you think about reef fishes, a lot, we see these really bright fish like angel fish, a lot of the wrasses that have these interleaved bright yellow and blue stripes. But when reef fishes are not that good at seeing over about 550 nanometers, so they don't see a lot of the yellows and stuff. And these complementary colors at a distance then will tend to blend in and look gray. So a lot of these colors that we think are really startling and amazing to us, the fishes are using them to camouflage themselves and blend in with their environment.
Because fish don't necessarily see colors the same way.
Exactly. You have to kind of look at how their spectral capabilities, yes.
Thank you both so much for being on our show today. Please Explain, looking at bioluminescence and glowing in general. I've been talking with John Sparks of the American Museum of Natural History and David Gruber, their exhibit, Creatures of Light, Nature's Bioluminescence.